security departments. And I'm Christina Onnestad, reporting for Pacifica Radio.
Welcome to Africa Now. Today's show features mine workers in South Africa. Update of the Stilfontein story. Africa Now is next. Welcome to Shaw Mwiza Mutali. The music in the background is Contusion by Stevie Wonder, and we play that commemorating his birthday, which is May 13th. First, I just want to thank the listeners for supporting Don't Forget the Blues with Clarence the Bluesman Turner today during our spring membership drive. Our goal for this hour is $500. Call today at 202-588-9739. 202-588-9739, or visit WPFWFM.org, or on our Cash App, which is the $ WPFWFM. Again, the Cash App is the $ WPFWFM, so that we can reach our goal of $500 and also possibly go beyond the goal. WPFW has been a site of resistance in defense of truth, justice and culture for 48 years. Our spring membership drive began with a special celebration of James Brown's birthday on May 3rd and closes with a centennial birthday celebration of Malcolm X on May 19th. Two pillars of music and message. Your financial sustenance is needed now more than ever. As a new listener or current member, this is your opportunity to contribute to the growth of an institution that stands resolute against both gross injustice and repression and the mass erasure of history and culture by amplifying the voices of scholars, artists, and activists whose work centers the humanity of all people. WPFW works daily to build the world we want to inhabit by building a better world one broadcast at a time. Be in solidarity with us today during our spring membership drive. Donate at WPFWFM.org, and you can also call at 202-588-9739. Or again, you can go to our Cash App, which is the $WPFWFM. Again, the Cash App is the $WPFWFM. Or by texting WPFW-FM to 801-801. Again, the text is 801-801. In the spirit of WPFW's mission of being a site of resistance in defense of truth, justice, and culture, and as we commemorate International Workers' Day, which is May 1st, also known as May Day or Labor Day, Africa Now features mine workers in South Africa. Update of the Stilfontein story with Chris Rutledge of the Mining Affected Communities United in Action, MACUA. And he's also a member of the Stilfontein Solidarity Committee. Christopher Rutledge provides an update on the situation of the mine workers who were in a standoff with the police for months while they were underground operating in an abandoned or closed mine in Stilfontein in Northwest Province in South Africa. Earlier this year, most of the miners were rescued, but unfortunately, there were a number of miners who were found dead in the mine. The discussion also highlights South Africa's mining history and its adverse effect on communities from colonial rule to apartheid to the current period, the role of corporations, trade unions in the mining industry, and more. Here is my conversation yesterday with activist Christopher Rutledge. Christopher Rutledge, welcome back to the show.
Good afternoon, Maria. Thank you very much for inviting us. We are privileged to be here.
Thanks again for giving us more information on what is happening to the Stilfontein miners, mine workers. And if you could just put us up to speed, just briefly give us the background of the Stilfontein mine workers who were in a standoff with the police for months while they were on the ground operating the closed mine and the current situation.
Yes. So to refresh the situation and to remind ourselves, let me sketch this first. So South Africa is obviously a mining country. We have relied on mining for over 150 years. It's essentially inside our DNA, as it were, as a country. And that has been a big part of how South Africa has developed in the world and participated in the world. And part of the growth of mining in the country has relied on workers from across the Southern African subcontinent, the Southern Africa region, as it were. So
yeah, and with that, it started during apartheid, right?
Yes, no, that happened
even colonial rule as well, I guess.
Absolutely, yeah. And in fact, the importation of foreign workers from across the region was a deliberate strategy by the colonial authorities to ensure that black workers were not able to organize unions, and so hoping that the language barriers, the tribal barriers and other barriers would keep them apart. And South Africa was intensely labor intensive, so they needed a lot of labor to extract the wealth. And in order to do that, they kept them in separate parts. So different jobs would be allocated to Malawians, and then some would be allocated to South Africans and others to people from Lesotho and so on. And the idea was then to keep them separated. But over the years, that was undermined through Black unity and, our collective fight against apartheid and colonialism. And so as mining came to an end, the resource under the ground is not an infinite resource, it is finite. So we're seeing that South Africa now has a problem where after 150 years of mining, many of these mines are closing down, leaving many thousands of workers unemployed and families destitute across the Southern Africa region. And as these mines have closed, Buffelsfontein mine in Stilfontein was a good example of what happens. So the mine essentially closed about 10 or 15 years ago. They just stopped operating, fired everybody, and the community that surrounds that mine was left destitute. So the mine workers that emerged from there, that worked in those mines, so South Africans and Mozambicans and people from Lesotho, from all over the region, were essentially left destitute. They knew the mines, they knew where the access points were, and as the mine owners abandoned that particular mine, the desperate working class men and women started to find ways to access these abandoned mine tunnels and to start extracting wealth because, South Africa has a massive unemployment rate. In some of the mining affected communities, we're just about to release a report next week. In some of the mining affected communities, you have unemployment rates that hover at 70% of the population in that community. And this is no different in Kuma and Stilfontein. And so it's just difficult to survive. And people are taking every effort to try and make a living. And mining, we know that the Buffelsfontein mine, when it closed, had billions of US dollars worth of mineral ore still underneath the ground, which the company decided not to mine any further because, it wasn't profitable for them as a corporate entity. But as artisanal miners, it's much easier. And so, for more than 10 years, the community of Stilfontein has been reliant on this artisanal mining operation. The state has failed to regulate the sector, even though we and other organizations have made the state aware that artisanal mining is a growing phenomenon in our country and that we have to regulate the sector so that we, you know, ensure that the resources and the wealth are distributed in a fair and equitable manner and in a way that is environmentally friendly and, you know, doesn't cause any further harm to the community and the environment. The state has been reluctant to do this because ultimately the mining model in South Africa, the regime of mining, is essentially based on corporate large-scale mining. So large-scale miners are given preference, and any attempt by the impoverished, unemployed local communities to try and eke a living out of artisanal mining has now been criminalized to the extent that people are, there's an operation that is a nationwide operation in which billions of rands have been pumped. And essentially, the billions of rands that the state is using to run these operations, which they call Vala Mugodi, which is close the hole, you know, those billions of rands are being spent to criminalize poor black men who are trying to eke out a living. And so this situation emerged in Stilfontein, where the state decided to tackle this particular mine. Then in 2024, around about January, they started patrolling the area, arresting people, stopping people from entering the mine or delivering food to those underground. But, you know, the operations weren't really successful because, you know, communities are resourceful. And where there's a need, there's always a will or always a way. And so the community continued to operate. But around about August of 2024, the police decided to escalate their actions, and they decided to man and close off all the entrance points that they could find. So that operation started in August. So for 3 months, the community were denied access to the miners below. There was, by all indications, a couple of thousand people underground at that time. And the police started to then close off these holes, denying people access to food, water, and medical care. And it was only in about October, November, when the scale of what was happening in Stilfontein became known. The first action was when the community negotiated with the miners underground. They obviously had attempted to negotiate with the police. And at some point, the police allowed some of the community members to volunteer to go down the mine to inform the miners that there was an exit point at a particular shaft, Margaret Shaft. And at that point, about 1,000 odd miners exited through that shaft. But what happened is that the different shafts, the different exit points for the mine, then even though they're all connected through hundreds of kilometers of tunnels, they are not all accessible. And so we found that there was a group of miners at shaft 11 of this mine that had no other exit point other than up a steep tunnel, a steep drop, if you will, a shaft that ran down for 3 kilometers. So the miners were at about 2 kilometers, they were there. And then obviously below that, you know, it goes down for more than 3 kilometers, but the mine was filling up with water. So you could only go about 2.5 kilometers down, but the miners that were trapped at shaft 11 was at about 2 kilometers. And the only way they could get up that shaft was through a pulley system where people on the surface would pull up one miner at a time or drop down food one parcel at a time through this pulley system. So the police had denied the community access to that shaft and denied the miners the ability to come out of that shaft through this police system. Because the police kept on saying, no, you can go through Margaret Shaft. But the community And experts from the mine themselves told the police that, you know, these miners in Shaft 11 are not able to access any other exit point, and therefore they have to come up. Despite that, and despite the community and Makua, my organization, going to the courts a number of times to compel the police to do this, they kept on denying or obstructing efforts to rescue and provide people with food, to the extent that we started to get messages from underground that people were dying and that the matter was urgent. At some point, the police then, after a court order, allowed us to drop down ropes to get people out and to drop food. And, you know, the bodies started emerging. The community volunteers themselves withdrew more than 10 people during that time, dead bodies, that is. And, you know, it was very clear that the actions of the state was now leading to mass starvation. Eventually, after many struggles and a lot of fights, we obtained video footage through one of the miners that we rescued. He brought up a cell phone in which he then was able to show this video footage. And what the video footage showed was just bodies lying as far as the eye could see. And as luck would have it, that video and that person that we retrieved the video from came up at the same time as we were back in court negotiating with the state at the court to, you know, institute a proper professional operation that would save people's lives. And at that point, when we finally got this evidence of people starving and dying in mass, did the state then eventually relent and agree to execute a professional rescue operation? The rescue operation was started the very next week, and within a couple of days, all of the miners were rescued. 246 miners were brought out alive. 87 miners did not make it and were deceased. And, you know, that then became what we called a massacre, a Stilfontein massacre, in a situation in which the state had criminalized poor Black people for being poor and had essentially starved them in contravention of a number of international human rights conventions and in what we argue in contravention of our own constitution and our own laws. And so, yeah, that's the background. I know it's quite a bit of a long one, but hopefully, you know, your listeners will be able to make sense of that.
Oh, no, I think it puts it in a good context, especially as we commemorate International Workers' Day or Labor Day, which was last week on May 1st. And as we look at our workers and as all over the globe, particularly workers who are marginalized, such as these that you're talking about. And again, I wanted to introduce a friend on the phone, sorry, on the Zoom, it's not phone anymore, it's Zoom, direct from South Africa. This is Christopher Rutledge, who is the executive director of the Mining Affected Communities United in Action. That's Makua. And he's also part of the Stilfontein Solidarity Committee. And we're looking at the current situation of the miners at Stilfontein, which he explained the situation they've been in and how they were underground, forcibly actually underground, one could say, on various conditions, first on the economic conditions, but also the security forces in South Africa not allowing them to leave the place. But I also wanted you to expand a bit more on what you said about the role of the community, because I think one of the things that is not properly explained or expanded on is how they had connection within the community, the workers, the mine workers, and how they're connected to the socioeconomic fabric of the community as well.
So, first of all, I must say that the community were the first people to raise the alarm. The state failed to actually inform the public, inform the community, or make any kind of relevant statement indicating that they intended to close the holes, close the access points, and to deny people entry.
Hi, this is Mwiza Muntali here live today doing our spring membership drive. And you're listening to a conversation with Christopher Rutledge, who is the executive director of the organization in Stilfontein, which is the Mining Affected Communities United in Action. And is also a member of this of the Stilfontein Solidarity Committee. And it's because of WPFW we're able to go deep into a story, which some of you have heard about. You heard about it late last year. About the miners who were forced to stay underground, and they were, as he mentioned, the police had to close all the shafts because they said they were illegally mining. And this is one place where you get to hear the proper context of a story like that, and also you get to hear people on the ground. And again, you're listening to African Now on WPFW. And also with me is Katia Stitt, who is the program director here at WPFW.
Hey, good afternoon, Netva. Thank you for bringing us another compelling and informative show. And as I have been saying really all day, that history and context are so important when we hear stories. And Africa Now consistently brings us the history and the context we need to evaluate, to understand the stories that are coming out of Africa and the African diaspora. So we ask people right now to go to the phones and pledge your support. We have only $400 to go, Netva. We have already two pledges, one from Isabel Charles. What a beautiful name. Thank you, Isabel, out of Kensington, Maryland. And then Anonymous out of Severn, Maryland, also getting us started. And we ask you right now to pledge your support, to make that call that makes the difference. Africa Now is one of the finest shows that WPFW offers. And we should not take it for granted. There are not many, and I would even dare say within the Pacifica Network, many weekly shows spotlighting, highlighting, focusing on, centering the African continent and the diaspora. So we ask you to support that which supports you. Mwiza does all of this fine work, as does his co-producer and host at times, James Pope, off the air, and they bring it all to the air to keep us up to date on what's happening on the African continent and throughout the diaspora. So now is the time, folks, only $400 to go. Again, if you are that person that's been listening for a while and you discovered Africa Now, and like many, like myself and many others, you really can't miss an episode, then it is incumbent upon you to support that which supports you. Become a member, do it now. It will not hurt and you'll feel so good, and you will have helped so many who may not be able to pledge right now, to support right now. We know people are hurting. So again, $400, 800-222-9739. Mwiza, I just want to thank you again for your excellent work and your excellent reporting. It really is a must listen. And the secret you all don't know is that as dope as he is as a public affairs producer and host, he is also an extremely knowledgeable ethnomusicologist.
I don't know what that is. I thought
he
keep up with you.
No, he brings it all to us. If you heard him Saturday night with Brother Saiz breaking down James Brown in Africa, so many things that Mwiza Muntali brings to us.
Yeah, and Netfa and I always confuse that.
He's also a dope musicologist. Yeah, you know what
and
I mean?
I am glad to be confused by Netfa, my brother in arms. So definitely a good company with him. Yeah, as we mentioned, you can call at 202-588-9739. Again, the number is 202-588-9739. I think I wanted to make the correction of the donation we got is two people. It's Charles and Isabel. And I know those people.
Oh, beautiful. I thought I did say them separately. Forgive me. Well,
yeah, I want to thank God. Those are might have to be my parents, I think.
let me tell you something. Oh, thank you for supporting WPFW, but also thank you for your incredible son. I mean, clearly, right? Apple doesn't fall far from the tree. And we appreciate them. And we want to appreciate others. So we have $400 to go. We want to get back to the well-planned show you have for us today, offering again history and context to what happened with this horrible and really criminal catastrophe with these miners. And so this is the kind of information that Africa Now brings you, that Mwiza Muntali and James Pope bring you. Now is the time for you to be in solidarity with Africa Now, with WPFW, and pledge your support.
And we're gonna go back to the conversation I had yesterday with Christopher Lutridge, who is with the Mining Affected Communities United in Action in South Africa.
So the state seemed to be acting deceptively under the radar, as it were, keeping in mind that Stilfontein is a community that is a rural community. There's nothing much happening around there. And so I guess the state had hoped that if they were able to execute this in relative silence, that nobody would know and nobody would care. But the community volunteers, at some point there were some artisanal miners who used to go down, they would go down in shifts. Mm-hmm. So the miners would go down, spend a couple of weeks there, and then come up. And some of the miners that had been on the surface when the holes or the access points were closed raised the alarm and went to community leaders in the community to say, look, the police have closed off access. It's been months now. People are going to starve down there. And this is becoming what the community at the time called a genocide, because that was how urgent the matter was. And the description wasn't too far off if one looks at the tactics that were used. But the community itself, as we now also understand in the aftermath of these closures, relied significantly on the operations of that mine. So that mine had essentially been keeping that community alive, remembering that this is a rural community. There are no work opportunities in that area, absolutely none, besides maybe a few retail jobs here and there, but nothing that can sustain the number of people in that community. And essentially the artisanal mining operations were the major source of income. And many businesses relied on it. And even during the siege, where the police had closed off the mine, we had engaged local businesses to elicit their support for donations to send down food parcels. And many of them indicated to us that even at that point that they had lost significant revenue because the operations in the mine had kept them busy and had fed the businesses. So an entire economy around Stilfontein was essentially devastated. Now, we think that that's quite significant because the government keeps on telling us that their actions were aimed at, improving the lives of the community. And yet what it resulted in was the absolute devastation, not only of people's lives, but of an entire economy. And the future of Stilfontein now hangs in the balance. People in the community are starving. We are having desperate problems trying to provide humanitarian support, funding from well-wishers and people who care has dried up. So we're not able to even give people a plate of food. We are starting a food garden now to try and have sustainable food gardens and food kitchens developed in that area. But that's not a long-term, while it has long-term potential, it's not came to resolve the economic question which underpins this problem. And the problem is that, in our view, you know, the way that the mining regime is structured, it ensures that the wealth that our country generates is channeled to a few elite shareholders, politically connected individuals, and their cronies and hangers-on, whereas the majority of the people end up living in desperate poverty with very few options available to them. And like I say, we will be releasing a report next week, which we are calling Looted Promises. And essentially, you know, the mining sector in South Africa was supposed to be the engine that would drive redress and development in our economy. And amongst those communities that have previously been the victims of apartheid and disadvantaged economically, socially, you know, through that process. But it's ended up being just a continuation of the apartheid colonial system, in which the wealth is sucked out of the country, and the people who bear the cost of that continues to live in poverty. So it is a desperate situation, and one that needs a resolution. And unless things change drastically in terms of how the mining is structured, how communities are valued, I think we will continue to have massacres occurring in South Africa, because part of our own estimation, our own assessment, our own analysis indicates that what happened in Stilfontein, this murder, the siege, this genocide almost of poor black men, is not something that is new to South Africa. We've seen this in the mining industry and across apartheid and colonialism over many, many years. And that what this indicates is that 31 years into our democratic state, that this is continuing. We saw it with Marikana when people were gunned down in broad daylight. And we're seeing it now in Stilfontein, where, you know, poor black men are essentially criminalized and murdered for the sake of protecting the wealth of a few. And that has to change. And unless it changes, we will see more massacres and we will see more uprisings.
And as you said, that this situation continue in other places. And as you're saying that, and how is the so-called established unions, because the unions were very much, you know, part of the liberation struggle. Mm. As a matter of fact, the current president, Cyril Ramaphosa, was the head of the National Mine Workers Union, mm-hmm. at one time, and led a massive protest, strike in 19, I think that was 1997, where, yes. Yeah, which was mobilized all the workers in the unions.
87, yeah.
87, yeah, that was, and as you're saying, especially talking about the mining sector in South Africa in particular, but yeah, continent wide, we're seeing this, you know, the plight of miners in Congo particularly as well, and other places where you have the rich resources, where the local people are not benefiting, the workers are not benefiting, and so you have this issue. As it's really part of the whole exploitative system. But how are the going back to what I was trying to ask, how are the established mine workers union, which is has a long history, working to support some of these workers in particular, or do they see it as part of their work as well to be in solidarity with these workers?
Mwiza, I'm afraid that the answer is not pretty, especially for those of us who have an affinity with workers and their struggle, and who have been involved in worker struggles for many, many years. What we've seen is that besides a few progressive unions, and I mean a very few smaller progressive unions who organize outside of the dominant mining unions, there's been no appreciation for the fact that these miners who were killed are workers. We haven't seen any kind of appreciation from the main union in the sector, the National Union of Mine Workers. We have seen some sympathy, but only distant, from the other union, in the other major union, AMCU, which is the rival to the National Union of Mine Workers, and which emerged during, just before and during the Marikana massacre. So they've voiced concern about what happened, but nothing more than that. And then obviously SAFTU, who also broke away from COSATU at some point, the South African Federation of Trade Unions, which broke away from the main dominant union federation, the Congress of South African Trade Unions, COSATU. So SAFTU expressed some support for the miners that were trapped. But even within their own ranks, they have been bedeviled by a deep-seated protectionism, if you will, which sometimes manifests as xenophobia and other times manifests as, union royalty. So in a country like South Africa, where the vast majority of people are not, or of workers are not in the unions. The main unions represent only a small fraction of the working class, as it were. I think the number, and I speak under correction, but I think the number's about in the region of about 20% of employed workers are unionized in South Africa at the moment. And of those, the major unions are made up mainly of service sectors. There's a couple of industrial unions like NUMSA and the National Union of Mine Workers, but the vast majority of COSATU's members, for example, are civil servants. So the kind of xenophobia and protectionism that emerges out of those kind of unions are now the antithesis of what those unions stood for in the anti-apartheid struggle. So the unions, to an extent, in my view, has become rather reactionary. They've become insulated, they've become inward-looking, myopic, and they have not been able to appreciate the fact that the working class of today are not only found in the unions. They are, in fact, the precarious workers who work on contract, the workers who worked without any legal protections, and indeed the artisanal miners who, are informal workers who try and eke out a living and are, in essence, also exploited by syndicates who operate these illegal economic pathways, some of them not because they want to, but because the state refuses to create formal and accepted pathways for economic development for the majority of the people. So we find that these unions are essentially becoming a lot reactionary. Their response to what happened in Stilfontein has been pathetic, to say the least. They have not been vocal about it. They have not seen it as an attack, as a direct attack on the working class, per se, which in our analysis, is an attack on the working class. It is, this is part of an attempt by the state to shore up the interest of large-scale corporations against the interest of the working class. And so the fact that our unions have not been able to step out of old archaic forms of organizing and of how they see solidarity has been, I think, one of the biggest shames of our time in South Africa. And I think you mentioned also that the political parties who were aligned to these trade unions, like the ANC, Cyril Ramaphosa being a leader of the National Union of Mine Workers at some point, as well as the Minister of Mineral Resources in South Africa, Gwede Mantashe, was also the General Secretary of the National Union of Mine Workers at some point. And so, you know, they have intimate knowledge of what working class conditions are in the mines, and yet they have chosen, out of whatever reasons, pragmatism or cowardice, who knows, they have chosen to see this massacre as a protection, a legitimate protection of the state, as it were. And they have been vocal about it. Mr. Mantashe has been absolutely fascistic, you know, much like Trump, in his responses to the plight of working people. The minister, for example, has said, well, nobody told them to go down there. And if you go into a dangerous place, you must expect to die. So he essentially says they went there to commit suicide, which obviously is patently pathetic as a response. It is patently unconstitutional in terms of our own constitutional. It is patently in disalignment with humanitarian values that are shared across the working world and across the world.
Again, you're listening to Africa Now on WPFW 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C., your jazz and justice station. I'm Muiza Mtalio, host and co-producer of Africa Now. And in the spirit of WPFW's mission of being a site of resistance and a defense of truth, justice, and culture, and as we commemorate International Workers' Day, which was last week on May 1st, also known as Labor Day, and also known as May Day, we're featuring mine workers in South Africa, update of the Stilfontein story with Christopher Rutledge of the Mining Affected Communities United in Action, and he's also a member of the Stilfontein Solidarity Committee. Also with me in the virtual studio is Katia Stitt, who is the program director here at WPFW. I think she has some news for us.
We have some good news. We have some good news. People are responding. We want to keep the calls coming. 800-222-9739 is the number to call. 800-222-9739 or WPFWFM.org. We received another generous pledge. Thank you so much. And they use the sustainer option, which is great. That is where you choose any amount and you spread it out over a year's time or 6 months' time, however many payments you'd like. And you do it that way. And you can pledge a large amount. You can pledge, for instance, $400, $100, $300, $500, whatever, and spread it out over monthly payments so it's comfortable for your wallet to do so. Anonymous says, Asante Sana, Muiza, for all you do and have done.
Thank you very
Absolutely.
Much.
We share that sentiment. Asante Sana, Muiza. So,
And also my colleague, James Pope, the executive producer and co-host.
Oh, absolutely.
Now.
It yeah. goes without saying. Forgive us, James. Absolutely. He's always there. He did an excellent show. I think it was last week's show.
Last week of Fanon.
Yeah, that was a fantastic show. Mm-hmm. Educating us, enlightening us, giving us history, giving us context. Same is happening today. So please keep the calls coming. 800-222-9739. WPFWFM.org. Many hands do indeed make light work. And Muiza and James do such a fine job for WPFW and for the community. And we're talking about the global community throughout the African diaspora and beyond. 800-222-9739. Keep the calls coming. Muiza, I know we have some more of this riveting interview to get to. Any words from you?
Yeah, I just wanted to just emphasize that it's because of this station that we're able to amplify these voices. This is directly from South Africa. It's not somebody that's based here. This is an activist, right, working with those workers. And he's going to talk a bit more. I'll let you hear what he's about to say about what's coming up. And so this is the only way it happens is because PFW exists, and it's because of the community support the last 48 years. So we really value that, really treasure it. And you can make the call at 202-588-9739. And you can also go to the Cash App, which is the $WPFWFM, and make sure you write in that it's for Africa Now. We're going to go back to Christopher Rutledge, looking at mine workers in South Africa.
So the response from the unions have been pathetic, to say the least, and it's a shame. But, you know, there are people who are working on the ground, rebuilding resistance structures, rebuilding working class formations, and it's painstaking work. But if we don't do it, as the saying goes, you know, nobody's going to do it for us. We are on our own, and we'll have to organize ourselves.
And again, the connection you mentioned about Cyril Ramaphosa being the head of the National Mine Workers Union during apartheid and organizing workers, but then today he's also was on the board of not today, but before he was on the board of the Marikana, the company that owned Marikana Mine.
Government mines, yeah.
Yeah. So there's that conflict of interest as well, all over the place. And I guess the other aspect, as you mentioned, which you didn't expand on, is really the COSATU's connection to the State Congress, Congress of South Africa Trade Unions. It's part of the government. I mean, it's allied to the African National Congress, ANC. So you have that complicated relationship. You think that also gets in the way when the unions are trying, when they're saying that they're organizing or working for the workers, that there's this conflict of interest?
Look, I think conflict of interests abound across society. And nowhere is that conflict of interest more apparent in the mining sector, as you correctly say. We, again, in fact, are making, in our report that we're releasing next week, we have a case study in which we look at a particular mine in the Northern Cape area of South Africa. That mine is majority owned by political interest, including Chancellor House, which is a vehicle of the African National Congress, the ANC. So that vehicle invests in capitalist projects, and the proceeds are then, you know, taken to the ANC for it to organize and so on. So what we see is we have a situation now where we have political elites who are not only making the laws, but they're also actively playing the game. So they are both the referee and the player. So obviously the referee, I must apologize. They're not only the referee, they're also the administrators, you know, so they make the rules, they apply the rules, and they benefit from the rules. So for me, there is very little, that's a perfect example of what the ANC has manufactured. They've manufactured a closed loop for themselves in which they are the ones, and the politically connected elites are the ones who benefit. And like we show in our report, it is the people who then ultimately suffer. And not only do they do that, so in the report that we produce, we point, what we do is we do a social audit, what we call a social audit of a mining company's commitment to the community. Now, as part of the licensing process in South Africa, if you want a mining license, you need to say, this is what we are going to do for the community as a benefit from our mining. That is called a social labor plan. Now, that social labor plan is then meant to benefit the community. So what we've done as an organization, we've done a social audit. We mobilize the community become their own auditors. We gather information, we assess the information, and then we go out and we actually audit that. So the mine might say, look, we are going to build a water facility for the community because they have no water. So what we then do is we go to that facility, we look at it, we check it out, and we say, okay, you said this is going to cost us 3 million rand. Did it cost us 3 million rand? And so forth and so on. And what is the benefit to the community? What we found is absolutely disturbing. We found that up to 80% of the projects don't even exist. The things that they claim that they've given to the community don't exist. Those that do exist provide minimal benefit to the community and are often often controlled and owned by politically connected individuals at the local level. So, you know, the community benefits nothing. So it becomes even the crumbs that are thrown off the table are stolen. So literally nothing is left for the community. And like I say, you know, nothing better epitomizes the injustice of what is being done to communities in South Africa by politically connected elites than the case of Mahojaneng, a community in the Northern Cape, and a mine, United Manganese, owned by the ANC through Transvaal.
And Stilfontein, as we were talking about the other mines that you mentioned that you're going to put in the report, I just wanted to also to remind the listeners that Stilfontein is south of, it's about 90 miles for the U.S. listeners, and about 140 kilometers, I guess, southwest of Johannesburg, right?
Yeah,
just to sort of put in context of where it is, and in that context, because of the mining sector in South Africa. But as we're talking about the all the conflict of interest abound, and also the U.S. policy. Before we go, I wanted to find out. You had mentioned that there's a lawsuit. Before we had our conversation today, you had mentioned that there's a lawsuit that you're bringing it to the courts on May 19th, right?
Okay, so we are still considering our legal options. So just let me use this opportunity to say that one of the things we did as an organization, we appointed an independent pathologist to inspect the bodies that were retrieved from the mine. And our pathologist has given us a report which indicates that all of the miners that they did autopsies on show clear signs of death by starvation or consistent with starvation. You know, so that issue we will prosecute at some point. We are meeting with the community next week to discuss our legal options. But in the meantime, the South African Human Rights Commission has called an inquiry into the events at Stilfontein and artisanal mining more generally. We've made a submission to the South African Human Rights Commission, and we will be presenting our oral evidence to the commission on the 19th of May. That's within 2 weeks from today. So it is a quasi-legal process, but the standing of the South African Human Rights Commission is under consideration by our constitutional court in terms of whether the Human Rights Commission has got the right to insist or compel the authorities to or any individual to comply with its findings and recommendations. So that is in dispute. So that's why I say it's a quasi-legal process at this point, but we will proceed with formal legal proceedings in due course as well.
Again, that was Christopher Rutledge, who was talking to us from Gauteng in South Africa. We're looking at the current situation of the miners at Stilfontein. And these are the miners who were in a standoff with the police for months while they were underground operating a closed mine. And then they were rescued earlier this year. And that was the conversation with Christopher Rutledge in South Africa. I want to thank all the supporters of WPFW in Africa Now today. And also want to thank Katia Stitt, who is with me today. Thank you very much. Making our goal. Yeah, thank you very much. And also want to thank my executive producer and co-host, James Pope, and all the Africa World Now Project Collective, and also Chanda Koza and Funangonda, Africa World Now Project Research Fellows and volunteers, and also all of the people here at WPFW, Michael Nisela, the engineer extraordinaire. Up next is Headline News, followed by Zain Al-Amin with Chawanana, and after that is Sophie's Parlor, the Women's Collective. I'm your host, Muizam Tali of Africa Now. Have a great day, have a great week, and stay safe.
For WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin. Today is Wednesday, May 7th. Here are some headlines. India fired missiles into Pakistan early today in the worst fighting in more than two decades between the nuclear-armed nations. India said its missiles struck nine sites in Pakistan's Punjab province and on Pakistan's side of the disputed Kashmir region in what India said was retaliation for an attack that killed 26 civilians in the India-controlled part of Kashmir last month. Pakistan denied any involvement in the April attack. India said its attack today targeted what it called known terror camps, but Pakistani officials said none of the sites were militant camps and that 26 civilians were killed. Pakistan said among those killed were two teenagers and a woman and child at a mosque. Pakistan's National Security Council called the strikes, quote, acts of war under international law, close quote, and said it authorized the country's armed forces to avenge today's strikes. World leaders and the United Nations are urging both countries to show restraint. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres called on both countries to exercise restraint. China, which borders the two countries, urged both sides to, quote, act in the larger interest of peace and stability, close quote. In other news, the conclave to elect a new pope to succeed Pope Francis, who died on April 21st, is now underway at the Vatican. 133 cardinal electors from all over the world are gathered to be part of the secretive process. A central question is, will the cardinals choose someone who will continue to build on Pope Francis's progressive vision and more progressive reforms in defense of the marginalized, or a religious leader eager to make a conservative course correction? The new leader of the world's 1.4 billion Catholics will immediately become one of the most prominent voices on the world stage and will grapple with the Church's budget deficit and fallout from its decades-long sex abuse scandal. In recent history, conclaves have lasted 2 to 3 days. In more news, a federal judge yesterday barred the Trump administration from using the Alien Enemies Act to deport Venezuelan immigrants without a hearing, saying the Trump administration failed to prove the existence of an invasion or another conflict that would justify invoking the centuries-old law. Judge Hellerstein is among several judges who have ruled the administration's use of the act is based on an illegal interpretation of the law, and that President Trump oversaw